Tweet at Radio Ray RTE. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Cormac Octorough is on the line. How are you doing, Cormac?
Good, thanks, Ray. How are you?
Good. A couple of things I want to talk to you about. I was saying I spotted that article in The Guardian today by Lucy Foulkes. Is the way we talk about mental health hurting us? And she's wondering, and it'd be interesting to get your opinion on this because you're at the coalface. She's wondering, is the use of words that were 10 years ago or 12 years ago confined to psychiatric dictionaries and clinics, you know, psychology clinics and psychiatric clinics, the use of those words by the general population describing things that may in the past have been described as low mood or a bit of a worrier or whatever, is that a good thing?
Yeah, it's a big question. I mean, I think from the point of view, there's a worry, I think, that mental health problems can get diluted into something. Some people saying I'm depressed or I feel, you know, I'm manic, or using expressions that kind of nowhere near what the clinical diagnosis is. And there are people who I would speak to who would feel quite disenfranchised that that word is used so lightly. And a colleague of mine, and we're having a conversation recently where we were worried the mental health dynamic was going to become the new gluten, you know, in terms of a lot of self-diagnosis of issues without proper, you know, and it becomes something that loses its value in terms of, you know, genuine gluten allergy versus, you know, it becomes almost a commonplace thing. I would always be a fan that everything is on that spectrum. And it's, you know, the idea of a low mood can become a depression, a worry can become an anxiety if we don't find our way out of it. So I think it's a difference in degree rather than difference in kind, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
But what we are doing is probably diluting meaning from genuine experiences that really isn't doing anyone any help. But to be honest, I think from the point of view of, it's maybe making people who are worried pathologize, and the people who actually have the authentic experience of it feel a little bit disenfranchised.
Yeah, that's what she's saying. So you agree with her. You're writing in The Examiner, working from home is not child friendly. So what's your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of discussions around the working from home is probably going to continue, you know, after COVID, and there'll be a lot more people maybe doing that. I just realised that here at home myself, Ray, my young lad came out and said, "Have you finished your meetings yet?" And I was kind of going, "No, just one more to go." And I thought, "Are you missing me?" And he said, "No, I just want the Wi-Fi back." You know, so it was this kind of moment. But it was kind of like, you know, there's a kind of a sense that they have to make a lot of changes and shifts, and, you know, be quiet and don't make any noise. And dad's on a call. And I was talking, I did an episode for the podcast where I interviewed lots of young people, and they were described being shushed for the last year as really difficult, like at home. And I suppose that was just maybe highlighting for people that we need to kind of keep the sacred spaces sacred, you know, and people who are working from home are reporting working well into the night. They're working on the weekends, you know. And the thing is, like, for me, Ray, like, a Monday night was my tag rugby night. I would never put anything in work-wise then.
And now you
Whereas
do.
Now I do. And, you know, GAA pitches on a Saturday and running to the soccer pitch meant nothing could be done. Whereas now I probably would do something on a Saturday where I wouldn't do it before. And I'm just wondering that when this stuff comes back, how tricky it's going to be to pull back again. Do you know?
Right, yeah. Well, I think all of these things will take over again, which is brilliant, and we look forward to it. Well, we look forward to being on GAA pitches and in swimming pools and all of those things. Okay.
For sure. Now, press play again. I think the pause has gone on long enough.
Okay, this came in for you, Coleman. My daughter was in first sixth class last year. What's that? Obviously didn't go to finish the year, which means she didn't get her sex education. It's something I'd forgotten about and have been putting off, but can't put it off much longer. Any tips or help would be so helpful. We did the basics last year, periods, etc., but not the birds and the bees. I did buy a book for guidance. I'm not embarrassed to tell her. I'm just afraid of messing it up. Thank you. So it's sex education for, it looks like 11, 12-year-old here. That's what we're talking.
The first thing I'd say is I don't think you will mess it up. Do you know what I mean? From the point of view of, I think this is a kind of a highly anxious conversation for parents to have. But in actual fact, the mechanics of what has to be said can be very easily delivered. The idea is that you don't, you know, over-inform somebody or under-inform. So the pacing of it, this child's in first year. They're going to be probably more informed about this thing, these sorts of things, than you imagine. But, and I'd be normally, you know me, Ray, I'd be kind of a less is more type of a person. But yeah. I think in this one, it's probably the opposite way around. I think this is a conversation as parents we tend to do too little of rather than too much of. I don't know of any child who's ever come to me having been over-informed in these regards. But from the point of view of, if you have a book, use the book as your prop. Have the conversations. It might be uncomfortable for you and uncomfortable for her. And, you know, it's not one conversation. You're going to revisit it throughout the thing. And, you know, if she is in first year, I would be very hopeful that this will be dealt with in the curriculum between now and sixth year again. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
But it's kind of, it's spiral information. So you give it, you return to the topic in more detail the next year, and then you return to the topic again in more detail. And so you're informing the child at their developmental level. But use the book as the prop, have the conversation. If you have a temptation to avoid it or kick it down the road, actually have it and make yourself have it. That would be my view, because I think far more people say, oh, sure, I'll wait and I might do that next week or next month, and we end up never having it. And I think we maybe subcontract it out to schools a little too much. I do think there's a parental responsibility around this, and again, maybe again, starting with the fundamentals and building on that as she gets older. But it's not one conversation; it's a series of them.
Yeah, and I heard good advice years ago: ask them questions. What do you think happens?
Mm.
You know, so that you can ascertain what they know to date, if you know what I mean. Anyway, so good
luck.
Yeah,
you get
that.
A baseline of where
yes.
they're at,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
you'll be able to pitch the conversation accordingly.
Yes,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Great
yeah.
idea. Yeah.
yeah. Right. Okay. Our 9-year-old has developed an unfortunate habit of lying. I caught her sneaking treats out of the cupboard the other day, another bad habit, and she was caught red-handed. She still lied about it straight away. I've tried to explain to her that it breaks down trust when you lie. I asked her to explain why she does it, and she says that she doesn't want to get into trouble. Is there anything I can do to break this new problem?
Yeah, I mean, 9 is a little bit old for that. I mean, again, you'd see that quite a lot in the 5-6 age group, where you'd see them do something and they'd still deny it. You know, there's a kind of an ostrich syndrome. If I don't admit to it, it didn't happen. But in this situation, I mean, she's a little bit older, so she will be able to manage it. I think for the learning in this, you may need to take a hit in terms of the sanction. So I would really push that honesty gets less of a sanction than a lie. So when you're saying to someone, right, you're good, you've robbed treats from the press, and I'm going to, if you come and tell me that you actually did it, you lose your device for 2 hours. If you don't, you lose it for 3. Do you know what I mean? So you're incentivizing the honesty over that. So you're selling the culture of honesty is rewarded within this family, whereas dishonesty is not. And again, it'll take you 4 or 5 trips to that to kind of let that sink in. But over time, it's about value system. So it's really about teaching that. You know, and honesty is not just about robbing treats, but it's about being honest across the board and having that culture within your home. But it may mean that you might need to let her away with something when she owns up to it and kind of take the hit on that one. But she needs to get the win from the honesty.
And I'll get your professional opinion on this. But again, I once read somewhere that lying at around that age is a sign of intelligence. is there any truth in that?
If intelligence is kind of cute savviness, maybe, you know, but there's obviously clearly a situation where you're caught red-handed. The most intelligent response is to own up.
Yes, it is.
but maybe not so much. But it might be more an avoidance or denial indication than intelligence, would be my guess.
Okay, Coleman, thanks so much. And if you book Coleman Nocter in, you can listen to Coleman on his podcast. And that article about working from home is not child friendly is available on the Examiner website. Coleman, thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Cheerio.
And Ishtar Shanam, the Preep Skelton, and Nocter, and Maura de Wallace.